Okay. Right at the beginning of paper 118, which is old single column, page 1294. Let's see, I guess, you know, right off the bat here, who would like to do the reading tonight? Got a reader here.
Is it difficult?
No, small words.
Nah, you can do it if you'd like.
A little bit profound.
Okay. I think the only preface we need is, now, let's make sure that we're really noting what they appeared to be doing in the title of this paper before we, you know, get into it at all. So that you always have that in the back of your mind is something that they're obviously hoping to convey. Supreme and ultimate, time and space. Obviously, it's in that order. They're suggesting that the more you appreciate the difference between the supreme and the ultimate, the more you'll appreciate the basic difference, the fundamental difference between time and space, and vice versa. Yeah, you're suggesting that you can use some of your sense already of what the difference is between time and space, knowing full well that that's probably clouded by a lot of limited initial perspectives, subjective perspectives, but nonetheless using that as an initial gateway to appreciating the difference between the supreme and the ultimate a little bit more. So it works both ways. So,
this is a physics paper.
The entire universe is a physics paper. Your deepest relationship with the Universal Father is a physics paper. That's fundamentally what the revelators are trying to get us to understand, that there is no distinction when all is said and done. Certainly on the infinite and absolute levels, the distinction between spirit and matter is in name only. So that the difference between the systematics of spiritual experiences, relationship, personal spiritual relationship between two beings, etc., all of that, has just as tight a systematics as dealing with automatons or uranium atoms or what have you, that it all has a very literal, rock-solid, logical first source and center behind it all. So that's just another parallel. The more you know about the way things work in the physical domain, you can transfer that over to the other side, to the spiritual side, and vice versa. It's another thing just, similar to this.
Even compare us to heavy elements, stability-wise.
Yeah. Boat anchors. Yeah, okay. So, just with that, just making sure that, we appreciate, because, I know people, often just kind of rattle that title off, supreme and ultimate time and space, but, I just want to make sure, if you ever stop to actually think about what they're doing with that parenthetical title like that, okay, creating that parallel. All right, so how do they start us out here?
Paper 118, Supreme and Ultimate, it's Time and Space. Concerning the several natures of deity, it may be said, the Father is self-existent self. The Son is coexistent self. Three, the Spirit is conjoint existent self. Four, the Supreme is evolutionary experiential self. Five, the sevenfold is self-distributive divinity. Six, the ultimate is transcendental experiential self. Seven, the absolute is existential experiential self.
Okay, now all you've got is just that initial list. But that, you know, is purposely a paragraph unto itself, because you need to really pause. They're, you know, it's very interesting that they're starting out with this very direct invocation of all that in-depth ontological study that we did a while back when we were going through the, you know, the three big ontological papers here in part three. You know, we were talking about the triunities and the triodities and deity and reality and universe levels of reality, and we went through, you know, we took it a notch up and went through that whole total deity paper where we really tried to take up that suggestion that they made back in those papers to see what they say in those papers as a suggestion for a starting point. And we took up that challenge. And right here is an example where we can put what we learned by taking that those next steps beyond what they give you, you know, as a suggested starting point in the book, and really start to run with it and see how that bears fruit. So let's take this list in three blocks. And just you don't need to look at it, but I just want to remind you, if you want to go back and think in detail, remember when we did the total deity paper, and on the second page, that is where we talked about those functional levels of total deity, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 levels that they introduce up in the foreword, you know, and that we finally were able to unlock the secrets of and begin to put them to practice as the domains in the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay, so I'm going to be, you know, invoking that, and we don't need to dive down into all of the nitty gritty details again. So it's okay if you don't have that to follow along. But I just wanted to remind you that that's what we're invoking. Okay, so think about those first three in the list. The Father is self-existent self, the Son is co-existent self, the Spirit is conjoint existent self. Now, okay.
What does conjoint mean?
We'll get to that.
Okay.
So the first thing to notice is they're purposely putting the final noun in all these is self. You know, it said that the concerning the several natures of deity, you know, and then they proceeded to not use the word deity in the list. Okay, and we've referred to this over and over that a good starting point for beginning to understand what the difference is between the Father and God the Father is that the Father is the self. It's the type of deity, and then that type of deity is personalized as God the Father. Well, you know, here they're literally putting that down in, you know, in black and white. So even though you don't know where the paper is going to go yet, you're kind of suspicious that maybe there's going to be an ongoing discussion about self and how it fits into the bigger picture. Yeah, and we'll see that as it, you know, sure enough, as you get into it. Okay, all three of them existent. Okay, you know, we know that the Father, the Son, the Spirit, that's existential deity. So the existent part is pretty obvious. Now, if you think back when we were very precisely distinguishing the various facets of deity, there was a facet of deity called self-existent deity. Okay? It was the infinite. You know, of all those different facets of deity that we were, you know, carefully examining, there was one that we put the label on, the infinite, is self-existent deity. Okay? So the infinite is that fullness of self-existent deity. Now here they're saying that the Father is self-existent self. It's like, so there must be some relationship between the Father and the infinite, those two facets of deity. And of course there is. We talked about that. If you think back, and this is where, you know, kind of invoke the image in your mind of that list there, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. remember how, you know, in each of those functional levels of total deity, there was two facets of deity active in each of the, you know, functionally active in each of those levels. And in six of those, they were the six facets that go in to make the type of deity called the Father. The facet of deity called the Father, you can think of as having six subfacets, if you will. Okay? And if you start down there in the supreme level, that, and we've pointed this out over and over too recently. Remember, you know, when we talk about the Father, that farthest extent, and lastly, the infinite upholder. Okay, well, let's start at that lastly end and remind ourselves what we did in total deity. When you, if you go to that end of this spectrum of the Father, if you will, and you look back up towards infinity, okay, you had the infinite upholder, that was self-experiential deity, and then we keep looking back towards infinity. The next thing we see is the universal controller, okay, self-expansive deity. Another notch back, the universal creator, self-distributive deity. Ooh, that must have something to do with a story we haven't told yet. Yeah, we'll get back to that one. So self-experiential, self-expansive, self-distributive. And then the next notch, the universal father, self-personalized deity. And then we're getting close back to the root here. We have the first source, or the infinite one, self-willed deity. That's the reservoir of all will. Yeah. Self-willed deity. And then all the way back to the root of the Father is what we usually term the first center, that one side of the universal one of infinity. It's on the Father's side, that the Father's side of the original, self-contained deity. Okay, see, every one of those in that list was self-something, okay. So, okay, yeah, it's not too surprising that they would say something like this, self-existent. But none of those was precisely self-existent. But remember what we recognized. When you look back to the roots of the Father, you see the even deeper root from which the Father stems. You know, you go all the way back, you know, and that whole facet of deity called the Father comes together with that facet of deity called the infinite. That's the Father infinite. You know, remember that term when they invoke that hyphenated term in the book? That's what they're invoking, is that full view of deity all the way back through the fullness of the Father and into that from which the Father stems. Okay, the infinite, the Father infinite. And there you have self-existent deity, you know, as the infinite. So just that first part of it, what do they see? What they're pointing out with the Father is that self of the Father is not literally the total of self-existent deity. But what the Father is as a self stems from that root of self-existent deity. From that self-existent deity, you get this expression of self-existent self. All right, and then the other two existential components, we always talk about them in this way, where you have the Father, you know, as the anchor of the three, because he's literally anchored in the root of it all, in the infinite. And then with him, the prefix C-O, you know, which is short for C-O-M, you know, all the various ways that you know, use that prefix with, you know, so with the Father, there's the coexistent self, the Son, and then conjoint, joined with. Okay, and it's called conjoint because if you have the Father and that which is with the Father, the superadditive consequence of the relationship between the two, joined together, you know, this with this together is one, the conjoint expression, you know, is so there's that conjoint existent self. You know, so at that existential, in that, let's just say that at that existential level, you have this threefold expression of existential deity rooted selves. And in the case of the Son and the Spirit, you know, a lot of times you can just think of it fairly simply that, you know, that the Son is the type of deity, the type of self, and God the Son is the personalization of that self, you know, the purposed self. Okay. So that's the first one. So now the key there to note that it's going to be true in all three of these is what they're pointing to here by saying self, besides presaging where they're going to go, is they want you to think about what, you know, where does that this particular self stem from? Is there a deity root from which it stems? You know, and in the case of the existential deity, yeah, it's the infinite. First in the Father, and then, you know, two and three. Okay, let's go to let's do number five now. The sevenfold is self-distributive divinity. Okay, now why did they say divinity and not self?
There's multiple selves.
Right, because there's multiple selves. Right, exactly. So that's that little technicality. We have multiple selves. Now, I mean, from the unity viewpoint, you have the one facet of deity, the sevenfold, but we know from the individuality viewpoint, that's a really complex expression of deity. It has gazillions of of individualities. You know, every Michael Sun, every, you know, master spirit, every master physical controller, you know, how many Frandalanks are there? There's a whole lot. You know, it's a huge plethora. From the individuality viewpoint. But from the unity viewpoint, you just talk about the sevenfold. It's one facet of deity. You know, it's one of those where the unity viewpoint, you got a unity, you turn it around and it's many from the individuality viewpoint. Okay, unlike, you know, you have the Son and the eternal, you just have the eternal Son, you just have one self, you know, from the individuality viewpoint. Okay, now, here, you know, we need to remind ourselves of this little chart that we've been looking at. Most of this we're not going to talk about, but the key is that column on the right, the sevenfold creators. You know, when you focus on the creator side of the sevenfold, did you, you know, sit and study this enough where you might have asked yourself the question? It's like, well, Chris pointed out that we have creator, controller, upholder, just like it's being in paper one there, you know, that we're in this order. And, you know, yeah, we got the universal controller, the infinite upholder. But I know that one of the facets of the Father is the universal creator. Why isn't that at the top of that list? Why is the universal Father at the top of that list instead of the universal creator? Yeah, if that's the creator column. I didn't go into that at the time, and we're not going to delve into it endlessly tonight, but there's a little technicality that you have to appreciate about that creator aspect. Just like you have these three here, drink of water here, with the self-existent self, co-existent self, and conjoint existent self. In that creator mode, you have the universal creator, and I'll do it very directly parallelly, the co-creator. Sometimes in this, with the second person, we'll talk about the coordinate creator, but that brings in the mother, and I don't want to do that right now. So I'll use a little bit more precise for this situation. So you have the universal creator, the co-creator, and the conjoint creator. So just in the exact same way, you've got that, you know, that pair, or that pair, and then the three. Okay. Now, why aren't those the first three in this list? Now, why is it the universal Father, the eternal Son, and the conjoined actor instead? Because that creator part is what really gives rise to the sevenfold creators. It's really what happens prior. It's the backdrop for the sevenfold creators in the following way. You have the universal creator, and with him you have the co-creator and the super additive consequence that give rise to the conjoint creator. And there's another name we use for that conjoint creator. That's the God of action. Right? Well, also at the same time that the God of action comes into existence, you get an immediate manifestation of that action. Drawn up out of the potentials comes Havona and all of the beings and all the creatures in Havona. And I don't know if you remember when we went through total deity, we talked about this. Okay, so there's this action where you have this cosmic phenomenon that's drawn up out of the potentials, and then deity reaches down to engage that creature-identified deity. The sevenfold is creature-identified deity. So you have the action, and there's a reaction related to that action. The sevenfold downsteps to engage those creatures in that domain, we're not focusing on the controller side, but there's a controller side, obviously, too, that's downstepping to engage Havona literally as a material domain. But, you have this deity reaching down to engage. God the sevenfold is the God of reaction. You have the God of action and the God of reaction for the reason I just pointed out. And see, that whole threefold action that gave rise to the sevenfold creators, is antecedent to this. That's why they're not in here. That literally functioning, the Father functioning in that aspect as the universal creator, not as the universal Father or whatnot, is what's giving rise to this. It's not it. It's what because this is the reaction to that action. Okay, so that's why, technically, it isn't immediately obvious why you don't have universal creator, universal controller, and infinite upholder like that. Okay, but think about what I just said. So I just said that the sevenfold has something from which it stems. Okay, and at the root of that from which the sevenfold stems was the universal creator. The name for the universal creator, the label that you give to the universal creator is self-distributive deity. Okay, from that root of self-distributive deity, in a very complex fashion, but nonetheless, from that root of self-distributive deity comes self-distributive divinity, the sevenfold. Okay, so from self-existent deity, we got the three existential facets of deity here, and then from that, from one of those facets of the Father, from self-distributive deity, we give rise to all of these selves, these self-distributive selves. We're really looking at it in kind of this unity viewpoint. That's why they didn't say selves; they said divinity. They put it all together. The collective divinity there. All right, so that's two of them. Like I said, this is a bit of a big way to start this paper. Okay, to really think through what they just said, and then the third thing. And this ought to remind you of when we were going through total deity, because this was the big discovery that we made. This is what we finally figured out by methodically going through all the facets of deity and getting them put in the right place in the picture so that we could coordinate it. We made a huge discovery. And in the process of that discovery, we gave labels to what we discovered. We labeled three facets of deity that were basically hitherto unrecognized until you carefully laid it all out. We called it evolutionary experiential deity, transcendental experiential deity, and existential experiential deity. We called it the finite upholder, the absonite upholder, and the absolute upholder. We found the mother. Remember? We found those three hierarchical expressions of the mother, of experiential deity. Just like we had these three existential, you know, we had these three experiential. Those three, behind those three is the mother. You know, those are three downstepped expressions of the relationship between the infinite upholder and the Paradise Trinity, you know, the functioning of the Paradise Trinity. Remember the, for instance, just, you know, one of them, the finite upholder, that evolutionary experiential deity, that was the relationship between the Trinity of Supremacy, the Trinity functioning on the supreme level, and the infinite upholder there, that it meets there in the midst of its functioning. So there's a super additive consequence. The relationship between those two, the Trinity of Supremacy and the infinite upholder, is the finite upholder. Okay, it's evolutionary experiential deity. Okay, so so think of them one at a time. You know, this doesn't say the supreme is evolutionary experiential deity. It's not the totality of it. You have this evolutionary experiential deity. Okay, and there is one very primary expression of that deity, that, you know, there is one self that stems from that root, very definitive primary self that stems from that root. The supreme as the mother stems from that root of evolutionary experiential deity, the finite upholder. You know, and a lot of times when you're talking about the big picture, you can just talk about them synonymously. The supreme as the mother is the finite upholder. But, you know, this is reminding us of a little technicality, because that same finite upholder type deity doesn't just express as that one self. What's an example of another self down here in the finite that's a mother expression, a finite upholder expression, but it's not the total finite?
Creative Mother
Spirit. The mother type deity that's in the Creative Mother Spirit. You know, there's two types of deity that are together as one in a Creative Mother Spirit. There's the spirit type and the mother type together as one. That mother type deity is another expression of evolutionary experiential deity. Okay. But the primary self, and of course, once the grand universe is settled in light and life, we all know that those Creative Mother Spirits condensed down into points, and, you know, this, in a sense, this whole complex distributed expression of the finite upholder type deity condenses. And, you know, it's a little bit hard to understand exactly how that all works, but, it, you know, right now, it's a bit like the sevenfold, and it's not just one self. There's this whole hierarchy, you know. We have a whole hierarchy of cosmic mothers, you know. We've been talking about this. This whole expression of the mother type deity has a lot of complexity to it, and we can imagine that transcendental experiential deity, the absonite upholder, is probably going to have more than one self expression too. It's probably not just going to be the ultimate as the mother. You know, of course, it is already that case too, if we don't look at it in our temporal viewpoint. You know, there's got to be a lot of other expressions of the absonite upholder, of transcendental experiential deity, besides this one particular self that we call the ultimate. Okay, so it's very interesting that they started out with this pretty heavy-duty ontological, starting point. They wanted you, but they wanted you to get in this mode, and we should try to figure out why. Why do they want us to really, you know, the only way we could understand this is to do what we've done. You can't even understand the way we just did by just what's directly in the book. You have to take their suggestions and run with it, put these pieces together, figure out all that, you know, all that we did, you know, and then you really appreciate what they're talking about here. Each one of these things, they're trying to remind you of how there's a self that stems from some root. Yeah. Yeah.
When you were saying before about the Father, mm-hmm. there's the Father and the Son with the Father, is mm-hmm. that combination the conjoint?
No. No, the superadditive consequence.
Oh, okay. The superadditive consequence, but is that a yeah. is that only the combination of those two?
In this, when we're just looking at the direct personalizable side of the equation, there's the non-personal side of the third source and center too. He's not only a conjoint spirit, a conjoint personality. He's also a conjoint energy and a conjoint pattern, and that's the relation. It comes from the relationship between the universal controller and the Isle of Paradise. Gives a whole parallel expression, and you know, you've heard me mention this. I mean, you said we've got three experientials and three existentials, but those aren't quite direct parallels there. You know, we now can appreciate really how that works precisely. You know, if you when you think about, well, let's do the experientials. When you think about the supreme, the ultimate, and the absolute, the overarching facet of deity is the Mother. And the Father, we know, is a coordinate overarching facet. Okay? And there's got to be three things under it. See, so the Father is not one of the things underneath. The Father is the overarching facet. The three existential things underneath are the Son, the Spirit, and the Isle. Okay? See, so in the fuller perspective, you know, each of these sets of three has two that, from our viewpoint, we can very much think of in personal terms, but each of them has one that is more difficult to think of in personal terms, like the Isle. Okay, well, that's just pattern. You know, that's energy pattern. That's not spirit pattern. That's not a personality. But we do talk about God the Absolute. Yeah, but there's, you know, you have to really understand the details there, because one of the things that went into that type of deity, the absolute type deity, is the unqualified absolute. Which is like the Isle, you know. Both of them have a component where this simplistic viewpoint that we have right now as finite beings, where we put spirit on one side and energy on the other, see, it blurs on the endpoint in each of those sets of three.
Okay, I want to try to get this. So now you talked about the parts that are coming up from the bottom and being met.
Mm-hmm. God. Action and reaction.
Right. Yeah. And it seems like, at what point does the part coming up from the bottom, and where does it get the self, the personality part? Where's the potential from that? Does that only happen once the top comes down to it? Or where does that
come from? Well, like for instance, you know, here, you know, when you think about the sevenfold creators, remember they're reaching down to engage beingness. You know, this side was reaching down to engage thingness here, you know, the things and beings. Well, in order for this side to become a being, a person, one had to create it as such. You know, the Father, you know, puts you in that volitional circuit, you know, and you are now an active being. Okay? So, you know, you can see, just thinking about yourself down here as a being, you know, why you need the Father in there as part of that. You know, you draw, you know, the actuality up out of the potentials. You know, the potentials become actuals. What reaches down and engages those actualities and makes them realities. Well, in the case of a person, the Universal Father, you know, engages it, engages you and makes you not just an actuality, not just an energy phenomenon, but gives you personality, makes you a reality. Yeah.
So what about the creatures and critters and the mother part? What makes it personal?
Well, like I said, there's a lot of complexity here.
And actually makes it.
I mean, that, you know, that's kind of what you're, you know, beginning to appreciate by putting this chart into place, is to appreciate how you have that which you directly understand as the sevenfold, you know, that's the god of reaction that's coming down to engage the spirit and the energy side, but there's the mother side that extends down to engage as well, and it's all combined together.
So is it
in complex ways.
So is it, when you were talking about it before, mm-hmm. I hope I'm not getting off subject, but I'm going to do it anyway. remember you were talking about, you know, they dipped in for the personalities and then
yeah,
they came down.
Right.
And, but did they, for the mother part of it, did they? It came a little different. It came from the same pool.
Right. There's
and
that.
How did it come down again?
I mean.
So that it can go back up and.
Well, I mean, part of that differential is in that when you start with that reservoir of all will, back when you're talking about the infinite one, sort of in a primordial state, and it's total will. It's all the will. There's a first step really before anything gets happened. Remember it's split into two pools of will. There's first source personality and third source personality. And the Father is obviously the one that handles that first source personality. You know, and what we came to recognize that when you're talking about the third source personality, that personality that is directly being doled out by the third source and center, that it takes on two different characters. Some of it is very much engaging the controllers. Some of that personality is meant for the controllers, but other of that personality is meant for the mothers to come into existence. You know, like our creative mother spirit is a third source personality. So, you know, you can, you know, the fact that you have the conjoint actor, the infinite spirit, and the infinite mother spirit. See, I mean, in a sense, they have the ability to cross over to the, you know, those three on that top level. You know. Really link those three columns together, and that personality can move over into the controller column and go down. It can move over into the mother column and go down. But the first source personality is all coming straight down here from the Universal Father. So in the details, you know, we'll get into that some when we get a lot of these details. We'll, you know, we're going to touch on them again pretty soon. We're going to be up to the forward, and you know, we're going to turn through a lot of these, you know, when we get there. So I don't want to belabor it here now, but anyway, all right. So it's going to get a lot lighter now. You know, a lot of this is fairly straightforward after that. So it's very fascinating how they front loaded this. Yeah. Yeah. All right.
Even yours, Don.
I think I'll just skip this.
No, you can do this. All right. Okay.
While God the Sevenfold is indispensable to the evolutionary attainment of the Supreme is also indispensable to the eventual emergence of the Ultimate. And the dual presence of the Supreme and the Ultimate constitutes the basic association of sub-absolute and derived deity, for they are interdependently complemental in the attainment of destiny. Together, they constitute the experiential bridge linking the beginnings and the completions of all creative growth in the Master Universe.
And let's just bring in one little tiny detail, kind of in the total deity picture, about precisely some of the things that they're invoking there. You put the supreme and the ultimate together as one. You call it the supreme ultimate, you know? Okay. And they're talking about that as a bridge between beginnings and completions. So just, you know, they gave you right in black and white there the beginning, the sevenfold. So you can think of the sevenfold, and then we span this whole space with the supreme ultimate to the completion point. You know, who is at that completion point? The consummator of universe destiny.
Yeah.
Right?
See,
and remember precisely how that works. You have that second experiential trinity consists of God the Supreme, God the Ultimate, and the consummator of universe destiny. See, so literally, you know, in that second experiential trinity, you have the Supreme Ultimate there engaging the consummator, you know, the completion point. Okay? And they're just pointing out, you know, don't just think of that all the way up there against, you know, that sort of co-absolute interface up there, where you have the supreme ultimate and the consummator. Because the supreme, I mean, we talked about this, I think, last time, didn't we? You know, remember, the supreme as the supreme being is in the first experiential trinity, and the supreme is intimately involved in the sevenfold. I mean, a lot of how the supreme comes into existence is through the supreme creators functioning in the sevenfold. See, they're trying to remind you that when you talk about supreme ultimate, don't always have your thought go all the way to the end point. It's here and now, too. For instance, the master spirits, they invoke the supreme ultimate when they talk about them. So when we finally get around to paper 16 and talk about them, you know, we can bring that up. Okay? So it's that. Think of it in the whole spectrum here.
In the same way that the third source and center is the super additive of the Father, Son, is the, in this case, in this particular trinity, and I suppose in every trinity, is the consummator the super additive of the supreme and the ultimate?
No, it's a little different there in the two experiential trinities. You've got antecedent following things happening there. You can't think of it in the linear way that we like to do of first person, second, third. You know, I mean, before you get the finite going, you have the architects, you know, as absonite beings, you know, preceding it. See, same way for the absonite, you have the consummator. The consummator of universe destiny, you know, he's a combination of a couple types of deity. He's the absolute one, and he's the absolute capacity. So he's this absolute type deity, see, that's engaging, is the interface point down into the absonite. So, you know, if you think of it that way, that's, if you're thinking top down, the absonite comes into existence through the conduit of the consummator coming down from the absolute level, or the other way, in order, you know, the supreme ultimate through the consummator can engage the absoluteness above, if you look at it from the bottom-up viewpoint. So, all right. Fortunately, there's a big break, and it's going to back off even more here. See, big paragraph break, it's going to back off even more. Okay.
Supreme growth is unending, but ever satisfying. Endless in extent, but always punctuated by those personality-satisfying moments of transient goal attainment, which serve so effectively as the mobilization preludes to new adventures in cosmic growth, universe exploration, and deity attainment. While the domain of mathematics is beset with qualitative limitations, it does provide the finite mind with a conceptual basis of contemplating infinity. There is no quantitative limitation to numbers, even in the comprehension of the finite mind. No matter how large the number conceived, you can always envisage one more being added, and also you can comprehend that that is short of infinity, for no matter how many times you repeat this addition to number, still always one more can be added.
Just one little thing, since I've mentioned this a few times. Notice they're contrasting the qualitative and the quantitative limitations. What's the fundamental qualitative limitations of what we know of as mathematics right now? It's very fundamentally linear. It's very, very crudely finite. You can't use the mathematics we have now to calculate the superadditive consequence. You know, that very fundamentally nonlinear phenomenon of 1 plus 1 is greater than 2. So that's what they're pointing out. It has that qualitative limitation. But quantitatively, you know, it gives you a way to begin to think about infinity.
That's why you need to use music as an example. You get harmonics.
Harmonics. And then we know that, you know, in the next life we'll have Marantia mathematics. You know, which, turn it around. That's going to give us all new insights into music.
In order to get them, you don't have to master the mathematics here.
Complex variable theory, I think, is on the first mansion world.
We work with Marantia mathematics right now. Are you getting into the relative side to the conversation?
We can't even conceive of Marantia mathematics right now.
I know, but we're still applying it to ourselves.
No.
Know the formulas.
No.
Do you know them, Jay?
They exist.
Okay.
Right. Yeah. I mean, it's purely a function. It's purely a function of Marantia consciousness, which we don't have right now.
I was kind of unconscious.
But we don't apply the Marantia mathematics. What we apply is the facts that Marantia mathematics is describing. Your mind has a lot of nonlinear aspects to it, even at a very rudimentary level. You know, like we've talked about a lot of times, you look across the room at a picture, you know, you don't go to the upper left-hand corner and rasterize that thing, you know, and bring it in one pixel at a time, scrolling from left to right, top to bottom. You absorb that whole image all at once. You absorb it nonlinearly. You don't absorb it linearly.
Yeah, you see it as a whole.
See, and Marantia mathematics will be able to describe some of that nonlinear stuff.
The thought adjuster, I was going back through this paper about the thought adjuster, and it was talking about picturizations of destiny that it tries to impress. So the thought adjuster is using that holistic method of picturizations. Right. Which is not even a word in
there's
our
language. There's a limit to how far down into this crudely linear domain of mind the adjuster can penetrate. You know, that's why normally you got to get yourself up to third circular before it can engage you. I mean, it's fundamentally very nonlinear in the way it engages mind, and you know, it can't drop all the way down to the zeroth level of meaning. You know, with your animal origins. So, it fundamentally is putting things there in a pretty holistic fashion.
Let me ask you this. The soul is a Marantia phenomenon.
Right.
And I can see that size matters when it comes to soul. So maybe he's got a point there. If you've got enough soul, you know, Jesus Christ, then you can engage some Marantia mathematics slash reality.
Now, you have to actually transfer your seat of your conscious to your soul.
Not before. I mean, we do have souls now.
Right, but remember how we talked about how that consciousness is separate. There's three selves in play right now, and you know the active personality self is the one that's seated on the brain, material mind. Mathematics is a function of that consciousness. See, that's what I say. You don't have it. You can think about how abstractly the soul's consciousness has whatever. But
doesn't the soul have a reflective quality back to that original soul?
Right, but see, it's not gonna be of that direct. How do I want to say that? I mean, it's not like there's mathematics going on there. There's just consciousness. And so you're not bringing mathematics over into here.
Right. Well, I don't want to get lost in the mathematics.
Okay. But that it brings in it right, like it catalyzes the nonlinear quality of your mind. It just doesn't bring awareness of Maranja mathematics into your mind. Okay. Yeah. That's what I was saying. I mean, it brings the facts, but not the awareness of the facts, you know, of nonlinear character. I mean, because even your agitate mind has a lot of nonlinear character. You don't even need to bring the soul into the picture. So it's just that right now we have a very limited ability to actually analyze and understand even our agitant mind because of its fundamental nonlinear character.
Chris, are you saying you can participate but not really capitulate?
You're participating in this. It's just that you can't step back and analyze it. You have no ability to do that yet. You know, you're just immersed in it. Hmm. Okay.
Almost like the animals. Mm-hmm.
At the same time, the infinite series can be totaled at any given point. And this total, more properly a subtotal, provides the fullness of the sweetness of goal attainment for a given person at a given time and status. But sooner or later, the same person begins to hunger and yearn for new and greater goals. And such adventures and growth will be forever forthcoming in the fullness of time and the cycles of eternity.
Okay, just, I've got a note, ooh, they put me in the space where those words didn't just pass by me. They forced me into the whole total deity contemplation right at the very beginning of this paper. And I know what we're actually talking about when we talk about cycles of eternity. Okay, we're talking about, you don't have a cycle until you've got a closed path that you're thinking in, until you have the infinite eternal ellipse that you're thinking in. And this definitely, earmarks this paper as one of the ontology papers, because the other two times that they use cycles of eternity is back there in those other three ontology papers. And it's actually interesting to note, they use cycles of eternity three times, and it's in three different ways. Three different ways they want you to go think around the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay, the first time is really they're taking individuality around the list and invoking that by getting you to think about the seven absolutes of infinity. So individuality around the infinite eternal ellipse. And the second time, they're taking the Father around the infinite eternal ellipse. And here, they just took, this basic deity. You know, there's seven of them here. And we know that Father, when it's kind of rooted in the infinite. I mean, you can go all the way around the infinite eternal ellipse in this sort of unity mode. So you have an individuality mode around the ellipse and a unity mode around the ellipse and a Father mode around the ellipse, and there's one more mode, the Mother. See, we can add a fourth circuit around the infinite eternal ellipse now that we've got, in the previous paper, we've got Mother fully in play.
What do you mean an ontology?
That's the study of the nature of being or reality. The onto part is Greek for being.
Okay.
So in other words, it's metaphysics, of that most abstract, if you will, vantage point or picture. What is the basic beingness of everything that I'm going to think in to try to create some framework? That's ontology. You have ontology and cosmology, sort of the two facets of metaphysics. And with endless falsehood, cosmology has been, taken out of metaphysics and made physics. So you know how much you can trust all of that. It's difficult enough, and it's in the metaphysics state, as we know from the relators trying to point out. And you take it out of the humility, at least of that pretext, and you know, and assume it's a science. You know, it's no wonder that all the things that they think that they've figured out in so-called cosmology doesn't match the cosmology. Okay, yeah. It has almost no chance of having any relationship. You know, especially because they don't have the ontology that you need to really, before you start talking about cosmology, you need the even bigger picture, you know, in which that cosmology or you know, that gives rise to that cosmology. The cosmology is created, you know.
Okay. And there's cycles of infinity.
Cycles of eternity.
Eternity. Aren't we also traveling that cycle, you know?
We'll get to that. We're going to talk a little bit about that, so let me hold off on that. But just, you know, the basic picture is, you know, you imagine going all the way to eternity, but when you get to eternity, you connect with infinity, and you go around again and again and sure. in the endless cycles of eternity.
Sounds almost, you know, yeah. Eastern, you know, yeah. the Vedas.
Sure. Right. Sure.
Each successive universe age is the antechamber of the following era of cosmic growth. And each universe epoch provides immediate destiny for all preceding stages. In Havona, in and of itself, is a perfect but perfection-limited creation. Havona perfection expanding out into the evolutionary universes.
Super universes.
Super universes, thank you. Finds not only cosmic destiny, but also liberation from the limitations of pre-evolutionary existence.
Okay. You know, and even maybe just a one little passing thing there, you know, if you go back and look at what the functional levels are called, there's an evolutional level, remember that? So when you talk about pre-evolutionary, you know, so if I backed up from the evolutional level, I get the creative level. You know, and we just talked about, you know, that basic initiation phenomenon of giving rise to the God of action, you know, the threefold creator, and Havona, see, coming out of that. In that pre-evolutionary, i.e. in that, you know, as a direct expression of this creative level, not the evolutional level of deity functioning. Deity functioning on the creative level gave rise to Havona. Deity functioning on the evolutional level, you know, is giving rise to the super universes. That's the sevenfold. Okay? So, little things like that, see, you now can, you know, it's like, yeah, okay, I understand that pre-evolutionary, but see if you can challenge yourself always to put it in the precise context. You know, they've chosen all these words very carefully, very precisely. So this all fits together, and you can think about this in very precise detail. See, it all makes, you know, complete logical sense the way it's all you know, constructed. You know, this picture they've painted in that book. Okay, so someone else wanna. You know, so you don't have to read forever. Someone else want to take up the next section?
I just want to point out that when they're talking about Havona is perfect, but perfection limited.
Right.
You've got a seeming contradiction. What's the play with words here? You know, we know that they redefine.
It's not infinite perfection.
Right. All I'm saying is that we need to rather than say, they're playing with words, you know, perfect is perfect. Mm-hmm. We need to say they are redefining words, right. And we need to understand where they're coming from. Right. It's perfect as in that previous sentence. You know, you've got a perfection that is a complete sphere, but there's more perfect available.
Right, and an even better approach to thinking about it rather than bottom-up viewpoint like that. Is take the top-down viewpoint. In the beginning, there was perfection. And that perfection was downstepped into a hierarchical structure.
Okay.
And, you know, and so at various levels, you know, and just take it very simplistically, you know, absolute, absonite, finite. something can be finitely perfect, but it's obviously not absolutely perfect or absolutely perfect. Okay, our initial very limited childlike bottom-up viewpoint, you know, it doesn't penetrate all the way to infinite perfection, you know, and so it says, well, I'm the source of everything, like I'm the source of the word perfect, and my conception defines it, and now they're forcing me to redefine it. Well, I guess I'm a free thinker. I'll let them do that or whatever. See, you know, turn it around. No, before you were perfect was, before any human penned that word, it existed. All human words are coming down from above. And not only do they come down immediately from above, they come down all the way from above. You can follow all these words all the way back up to their sources at infinity. You know, like the duality of time and space. We've talked about following that all the way back up to the point where we say in the beginning was the I am. And, you know, we know that as soon as we conceive of the separation and the succession of events that resolves the tension of that separation, we've got the source of this pattern, space and time, separation and succession. Everything can be taken all the way back up, perfection and everything.
What about bad words?
Only in the sense of when you begin to discover that the bad word is the absence of the good and not a separate actuality,
right. But
the absence of an actuality. Okay. So you go, oh, badness is the absence of goodness. Okay, and then goodness goes all the way back up to the source. And the very fact that you, oh, boy, that changes my whole ontology and cosmology. I don't have two parallel lines. But humans have always thought that. Yeah, well, that's because all they saw was this tiny little thing down here, and they can see, so as far as I can see, that badness line, it must go all the way to infinity. Just like the goodness line seems to go all the way to infinity. Well, that's because you can only see a nanometer deep, you know, towards infinity. Okay? And they're revealing you to what you can't see directly, experientially. That your assumption that the goodness line goes all the way back, that was a good assumption. That was a correct assumption. That was a false assumption. The badness line doesn't. It's a very tiny little segment down here at the bottom as a sidestep off of this little parallel goodness segment. And it only exists inside of the circumscribed domain of a mind. It doesn't exist outside of a mind that's been given free will control over that little space. There's no objective badness. There's only subjective badness. So not only is it not very deep, but it's not very broad either.
It's like a big bang.
Yeah.
It only goes back so far.
Yeah.
Big dud.
Okay. Yeah. And it's limited in breadth and depth and length. Remember how we talked about those three? It only goes for a certain length of time. It's limited in length too. So it's limited in breadth and length and depth. All three. It's very limited. But humans have always thought it was unlimited in all three of those dimensions. No.
And when you say word, we remember that word is a symbol trying to convey something.
Or the absence of something.
What is in the name? If flower smells sweet. that sort of thing. I mean, it's the symbol
representing. Right. The universe is literal. Goodness is not just an abstract concept. It's a literal substance with that quality. Okay? And, you know, the fact that there's a substance is why we, you know, without any real understanding, gave rise to the word spirit. You know? At the same time, it gave rise to the quality of that substance, goodness. You know, if it's under personality control, of course, which it is objectively, you know. All objective spirit is good. It's another great example of how they're trying to get us to turn this around so we can really understand how we fit into the picture. Okay, so who was going to do the time?
I'll read.
Okay.
Time and eternity.
Oh, boy.
It is helpful to man's cosmic orientation to attain all possible comprehension of deities in relation to the cosmos. While absolute deity is eternal in nature, the gods are related to time as an experience in eternity. In the evolutionary universe's eternity is temporal everlastingness, the everlasting now.
Yeah, you know, we all know how they're playing off of there and stuff, you know. But just again, notice they're explaining. The first sentence is explaining, why should I read this? It is helpful to man's cosmic orientation to attain all possible comprehension of deity's relation to the cosmos. Mm-hmm. Okay, that wasn't just an intellectual exercise to go through total deity. You know? Right, in ways that we can't even begin to imagine until we start actually just trying it. And notice how we begin to change inside. Mm-hmm. When we let deity expand our self so it isn't so limited. And it knows about self. There's an origin for self. Oh, wait a minute. Yeah, the beginning of this paper. Wouldn't I like myself to be more like this very vast self that's behind everything? Right.
It could be a structural foundation.
Right. Yeah. It's not just about being able to talk about time and eternity with some sort of, technical, detail.
You know, I was talking with somebody today, a friend of mine. We were helping out at the Indian restaurant. And he, I asked him, he's into Eckhart Tolle. Mm-hmm. And Eckhart Tolle lays out this, we were talking about it on the way up, Gene and I, he lays out this basic, the everlasting now, the importance of being. He's talking about being. And it's like, I'm starting to see it. Instead of seeing it as counter to what I believe, I'm starting to see it as incorporating. It's just the first step. It's a basic first step. It's being, laying out the foundation, for the ontology and then the cosmology coming up from it. Just a basic ontology.
Right.
It's a recognition, an awareness, and that's their technique. It's a technique of awareness. Mm-hmm. He can't talk about it. It's just, it's very, but those few words kind of describe what I describe was what he passed on to me.
Right. And we've already challenged the understanding of that title, so that we don't just have a line segment in our cosmology or ontology. You have time and the end point is eternity, It's an ellipse. It's closed. Okay? The eternal now. Now, obviously, from, like they're saying, while absolute deity is eternal in nature, the gods are related to time as an experience in eternity. They have an engagement of that whole, but there are ways in which they can recognize the circumscribed sections of it in various ways, or at various levels. So that's what they're getting at. But anyway, the everlasting now, we can really, that should invoke, again, the infinite eternal ellipse.
This is one of my favorite paragraphs.
Yeah, let's go for it.
Personality of the mortal creature may eternalize by self-identification with the indwelling spirit through the technique of choosing to do the will of the Father. Such a consecration of will is tantamount to the realization of eternity reality of purpose. This means that the purpose of the creature has become fixed with regard to the succession of moments. Stated otherwise, that the succession of moments will witness no change in creature purpose. A million or a billion moments makes no difference. Number has ceased to have meaning with regard to the creature's purpose. Thus does creature choice plus God's choice eventuate in the eternal realities of the never-ending union of the Spirit of God and the nature of man in the everlasting service of the children of God and their paradise Father.
And of their paradise Father.
And of their paradise.
Now, there's a bunch of things, you know, let's just quickly touch on them. Just, spend some time reflecting on this. But just, I want you to, there's poetry there. Now, open your material consciousness eye, too, not just your spiritual consciousness eye, and see how beautiful, that paragraph is. Little details you can notice, like the personality of the mortal creature may eternalize by self-identification with the indwelling spirit through the technique of choosing to do the will of the Father. Think about it. There's a twofold consecration there. See? It's not just a consecration of my will to the perfect will of God the Father. It's a consecration of myself, my mindal self, consecration of my mind to the universal harmony, see? God the Mother, that indwelling spirit, and we know how that works now. We've been really beginning to understand that thought adjuster, being tied to the mother column in here. Yeah, it has an existential father-like core, but we don't touch that. Wrapped around that existential father-like core is a mother-like casing. Okay? Right there in our mind, we've got this very poignant example of what myself ought to look like, what its mother likeness should be, its universal harmony likeness should be. Okay? See, so you got that there. Thus does creature choice plus God's choice eventuate in the eternal realities. Creature choice plus God's choice. Okay. Technically, what are we talking about there? Well, I choose to consecrate my will to the perfect will of God the Father, and I choose to supply the favorable conditions, but I don't actually grow my mind, do I, to be more like that universal harmony. God the Mother chooses to grow that mind in response to my supplying the favorable conditions. And you notice it doesn't say Father's choice there. It says God's choice. So allow the possibility. It may not be just talking about the Father. So see, ask yourself. You've got this twofold choice. God the Mother chooses to grow you. And you chose to initiate it and supply the favorable conditions of mind. To allow your mind to be reformable. Or you could be not allowing your mind to be reformable, and it doesn't matter how much God the Mother would like to grow it, nothing's going to happen. It's a block of concrete. And again, just notice this. The rest of that, this everlasting service of the children of God and of the Paradise Father. Notice how what it's saying. It's not saying the everlasting service of the children of God to the Paradise Father. The two of us are serving together. The Father, God, is love. And love is a verb. It's something that the Father does. Service, loving service.
We do together with
Him.
Wow.
See?
That's what Jesus was doing.
Think about how different that sentence is really than almost all human notions in the past about God the Father. Have you ever really seen the two of you working side by side like that with that verb, love? Or have you seen yourself in this totally bottom up, I humbly serve you, O Almighty? No, it's not your Lord Almighty, He's your Father. He's right here. You're serving together. Because love is a verb. And, God does not love any more than you and I are if all we are is something that is, not something that does. You have to do something as well as be something. Same is true for Him as it is for us.
Just like with finding God, there's a reciprocal downreach that goes with that upreach.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Love is fundamentally a verb.
Just dawned on me, this book is giving us a whole new relational foundation with God. It's a whole new relational foundation.
Yeah. Guess what? It's not, a foundation with, not just with of, God, but with everything.
Partnership. Yeah. Partnership instead of,
yes.
You know, king.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or, you know, yeah. Master,
and of course,
slave.
Jesus tried, you know, to do the same thing. And we know he didn't get very far with it. You know, he had to couch a lot of it in kingdom thing, which basically kind of made it meant that they wouldn't really get the Father thing. But, you know, he got the ball rolling. And now, you're right. Now let's fully take it up. What Jesus tried to teach us 2,000 years ago. See how they're doing it here again. Only now we've got the full ontology and cosmology to go with it. And so it's not just some, I guess I just got to believe that, or, you know, dutifully do that, you know, compulsion, duty, and convention, you know, first miler, you know, free service and liberty-loving devotion. See it in that, just like he sees it. Free service and liberty-loving devotion.
You know, the other thing that's really cool about this paragraph is that even though it's got that ontology and cosmology, it's got a simple instruction.
Yeah.
It says, this is how you do it.
Yeah.
And the other part of that, which I really like, is that it's saying that it can be done. Every single moment can be a God-conscious moment. I mean, it's harder than you think when you really try to focus on being, you know, God-conscious, experience of the experience of your reality. But, I mean, it's good for me to know that, oh, okay, if I'm going to believe this, and there's something inside me that says I might as well believe this, it's quite a wonderful goal to recognize that you could literally encase your God consciousness in every single moment that you exist.
Right, and think about how we talked, you know, back in the previous paper in section 6, they pointed out a specific of that. This initial initiation that the Father has given us, you know, we can do this, but take a deep breath.
Yeah.
Because it's going to take you all the way through the local universe to sort of complete this first step of wrapping your mind around that, you know, and actually having the God is the nucleus of everything. You know, again, think about it literally. So I keep saying it that way. Wrap your mind around that God nucleus. It takes you all the way. The mother influence dominates. You know, it's going to take you all the way up to the local universe to do this first step of wrapping your mind around that God nucleus.
So starting point. The previous step of fusion with the thought adjuster is not this.
That's just getting the most progressive parts of your mind wrapped around. You got all the rest of it still has Marantia scaffolding underneath it.
Okay. Yeah.
Yeah. Right. You know?
That's a big step, though.
Yeah, it is a big step. Yeah. Yeah.
At the very least, the revelation should do for us is to totally reacculturize us.
There you go.
At the very least. Yeah.
And you'll see they're going to get to that patient step in just a couple of paragraphs. Yeah.
Chris, I just overheard, and I just wanted to know, you were using, I remember convention, you used that, is that in the same chart for legacy, tradition, convention, or using, what was that, compulsory? Was that the word you used?
No. I mean, remember. Compulsion? Yeah, remember the, go back and read the first miler. Go back and read the paragraph about the first milers and the second milers.
But is that?
Yeah, it's in there. Okay. Compulsion, duty, and invention. You know, those first miler traits. You know, and obviously it's going to be related to that very early notion of legacy, tradition, convention.
So they are in synchrony?
No, they're not. It's not a direct parallel, but, you know, they're related, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. Okay.
There is a direct relationship between maturity and the unit of time consciousness in any given intellect. The time unit may be a day, a year, or a longer period, but inevitably, it is the criterion by which the conscious self evaluates the circumstances of life and by which the conceiving intellect measures and evaluates the facts of temporal existence.
It's all, you know, they keep saying self. See, this is in the context of the self, not the personality first, but they're really talking about the self here, just like they started the paper out. Okay.
Experience, wisdom, and judgment are the concomitants of the lengthening of the time unit in mortal experience. As the human mind reckons backwards to the past, it is evaluating past experience for the purpose of bringing it to bear on the present situation. A mind reaches out as a mind reaches out into the future, it is attempting to evaluate the future significance of possible action. And having thus reckoned with both experience and wisdom, the human will exercises judgment decision in the present, and the plan of action, thus born of the past and the future, becomes existent.
Okay. Now, it's interesting that he brought up legacy, tradition, convention. Remember, we've talked about that past, present, future, that sort of very primitive notion of legacy, tradition, convention, you know, as a threefold relationship to past, present, future, and how the revelators were challenging us that if we're going to have advancing civilization, we need to take it up a notch to wisdom, insight, foresight. You know, we've pointed that out a number of times. You know, and in that, we, you know, that's the past, present, future thing. Well, if you remember that and you read this, you go, wait a minute, I'm confused here. And then they're using wisdom in the future contemplation here. Okay, how does that work? This is why it's very important to know what, where I am when I'm reading this paragraph. I'm in myself when I'm reading this paragraph. I'm not in my spirit personality. I'm not so much in the temple, you know, in that upper domain of the hourglass. I'm down here in that animal origin self down in the lower domain, but I'm getting the two more and more linked together through the neck, the level of the neck, the level of wisdom. Okay? So think about how this works. Put yourself up there in that real personality domain where you have wisdom, insight, foresight. Okay, that in that objective perspective, the objective relationship to the past that you're calling wisdom, where did that come from? Well, remember that level of wisdom, that third level of meaning, has two sides to it. You know, they just pointed out that wisdom that you have up there, it came, you know, you go down into the self and back into experiences of the self. The self is what has the experiences. See, so the experiences come forward through the self and through the connection, the link of wisdom up into the personality domain, and that's where that past perspective on that objective level came from. See? So in down in the self domain, you know, it's a personality, or it's a wisdom forecast. Because, you know, down in that self domain, you know, the personality has brought this foresight, insight, wisdom down into. So down in the self perspective, you know, that's looking forward. And see, the best the self can do is what the personality feeds down into it as a wisdom forecast, you know. But what it really, how that wisdom forecast came about is because, you know, wisdom, insight, foresight, the personality has foresight. The self doesn't have foresight. See, so it works both ways. I mean, that future comes down into the self from the foresight of the personality down through the wisdom connection. And the other way around, the wisdom up above here is coming up from the self, you know, into that objective personality perspective. Okay. That's how you put these two pieces together. Yeah. And then notice how they're doing this. Again, we're down in the self. We're talking about decisions. Okay, but we're connecting the personality picture into this, you know, and we're gonna make an assessment. We're gonna make a judgment. And then give it decision form in the mindal self. And remember, a decision is literally a form in that mindal energy system. You know, so it's not just going to be a decision, you know, a mere decision. it's going to be a judgment decision. You know, it's going to be a decision that resulted from an antecedent judgment, assessment of it. And you're hoping you've got a good, full personality self system going here so that it's not an unwise judgment that gives rise to that decision form. An unwise judgment is error. And you certainly don't want it to be a mistaken judgment, evil. Okay? You know, so the ability to not just be a mere decision form, but a judgment decision form, is because you have this linked system of the self, you know, and that objective consciousness that you have up there in the upper domain that's created by the three cosmic intuitions, and that objective personality domain that you can you know, assess things in. Okay? And so they say you have those decision or those judgment decisions, and then you know, what does it say? We'll exercise judgment decision in the present, and the plan of action. So those judgment decisions give rise to decision actions. You know, now we're not just being something; we're doing something. We've taken it all the way through the process. We've this whole thing has come about because we have self and personality all working together in a well-integrated system. You know, and it's been taken all the way to action. Now we're doing, but we're not doing the kind of doing that you can only that you do merely as a self. It's a doing that only came into existence because it's fully integrated, you know, self to personality, personality to cosmos. See the whole picture. That's the kind of doingness that we're talking about when you say you must do something as well as be something. The kind of doingness that results from this fully integrated, personalized self.
As you're talking, I'm seeing that most people think of the reservoir of experience as the only reservoir from which to draw information and say, okay, well, because I didn't know enough, because I didn't have the experience, I made a bad judgment.
Yep.
But there's another reservoir.
Yes.
And
the very fact that we don't recognize that other reservoir gives rise to an oft-quoted little bit of pith, you know, wisdom, so-called.
Yeah.
You can't understand something unless you've walked a mile in moccasins, right? Okay? No. You can learn by looking as well as by leaping.
Yes. Yes.
There are two reservoirs.
An animal learns only by that one
method. Right.
But humans can learn the second way.
See? See, just to think about how you know, way out of proportion we've blown that old notion. You know, that there's no way you could possibly understand something unless you've experienced it. Well, you know, it's like, yes, I can. It's like, well, you know, who are you to say that you can do that? Well, who am I to not say? I'm a mere self, if that's all I can say.
Well, and the other thing
I can
is
learn by looking as well as by leaping.
Just volumetrically, the reality of the experiential reservoir is a drop of...
Yeah.
Nothing.
The cosmos is a bit bigger.
Big.
Wouldn't it be helpful if I could bring in that reservoir?
Into that reservoir.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well,
okay.
And I think that going back to the previous paragraph or the first paragraph there about the moments is that the more you do that is a key to tapping into not only the experiences that you have had, but clarifying them via the prism of the larger reservoir.
Right. That clarification is why, so you won't make unwise or mistaken judgments. Same.
Yeah, that's nice.
Yep.
Remember their description of the good system and the bad system?
All right, so let's just look at this next paragraph, how it invokes that picture.
In the maturity of the developing self, the past and future are brought together to illuminate the true meaning of the present. As the self matures, it reaches further and further back into the past for experience, while its wisdom forecasts seek to penetrate deeper and deeper into the unknown future. And as the conceiving self extends this reach ever further into both past and future, so does judgment become less and less dependent on the momentary present. In this way, does decision action begin to escape from the fetters of the moving present, while it begins to take on the aspects of past-future significance.
And in that full context, you can go back to that second paragraph in this section when they're talking about such a consecration of will is tantamount to the realization of eternity, reality of purpose. Remember how I've tried to point that out? If you can, technically, I should say it that way, technically realize something, what have you done? You've wrapped it around the infinite eternal ellipse. Okay? Eternity, reality of purpose. If you've really consecrated, that's what you've done. Because that's what it is. That's what makes something real. If it engages the eternal now, if it engages the infinite eternal ellipse. Otherwise, it's just a circumscribed thing.
That's how it's fixed.
And you can do that because that personality has a way of reaching down and giving the self what it doesn't have in and of itself. Mm-hmm. Like they're describing here. More and more, that self can be made to reflect the cosmos. More and more, that self is not only consecrated to the universal harmony of the cosmos, you've supplied the favorable conditions, but it's been grown to actually be a reflection of that in this way, like you're describing. And then look at this next little fun little one. Everyone knows what this is. Just read this next thing here.
Patience is exercised by those mortals whose time units are short. Huh. True maturity transcends patience by forbearance born of real understanding.
Okay. And, this, we've talked about the technical. That's not just, fancy words. What are they talking about? They're talking about mere patience is exercised by those mortals whose time units are short. Because remember how this works? You're just starting to move up the levels of meaning. That third level of meaning is the level of patience. That's the kind of patience they're talking about. You haven't even gotten yourself up to that first thread all the way up to the sixth level of meaning. Okay, so we're not talking about maturity here in any sense. Okay, you need to be humble about that. Okay, but it's a start because, you remember when we've talked about the facets of cosmic character? One of those facets is forbearance, patient restraint. Remember, there's a bunch of those, patient love, patient restraint, patient courage. And then there's self-neutral mercy and tempered zeal. But, especially those like the patient restraint, the forbearance, think about that. Okay, that's a facet of cosmic character. That rises from taking that third level of meaning and combining it with the fourth to create one of these facets of this circular structure that you have up on a cosmic plane. Okay? And think about it technically. Okay? That mere patience as you're moving up the first time, that's just a patience in the moment. Okay? Forbearance, okay, to bear away, to forbear. Can you take it, can you bear it away from the moment into more and more of the eternal now? See, that's literally what that word means. Okay? I mean, it has a meaning, a cosmic meaning that humans have never even appreciated. I mean, look it up in the dictionary. Okay, you got the etymological things there and stuff, but they've never understood just how perfect a word that is because it comes down from above. The cosmos gave us the word forbearance, not us. We haven't tried to make the cosmos in our image. The cosmos is progressively making us in its image. And it gives us words eventually, like forbearance, that describe this process of more and more having a consciousness in that self that's born away from the mere moment of the present. More and more, it's an eternalized consciousness.
It's
swallows up the time.
It's stability and the moving.
There's a first measure of forbearance, and then a greater measure of forbearance, and a greater, and a greater, and a greater, until it's an infinite forbearance.
When they say true maturity, they're referring to the cosmic maturity.
True. Yeah. True means conforming to the cosmos. That's what the word true means. Yeah. So you know they're talking about a cosmic character. Ding, 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 the facets of cosmic character, right? You know, is it, that's the beauty of the book. It all, you know, this is, you know, you figure those out from paper 84, paper 100, paper 140, et cetera, you know, and then there's the levels of meaning that you put all that stuff together, and it all comes to bear on this sentence right here to completely understand what they're talking about in this sentence.
Look at how they set that apart.
Yeah.
Plus the word, in front of understanding is real. That comes into play.
Yeah.
Too, doesn't it?
Right. Yeah. You know, that's personality. Yeah. You know, self can have mere understanding, but only when the self is linked to the personality is there real understanding.
Right. It's not like very good understanding.
No.
It's doesn't mean that.
It's a technical word.
Yeah.
Yes. Exactly. Yes. All right.
To become mature, we good?
Yeah, let's go ahead.
To become mature is to live more intensely in the present, at the same time escaping from the limits of the present. Escaping from the limitations of the present. The plans of maturity founded on past experience are coming into being in the present in such manner as to enhance the values of the future.
Wow.
Wow.
You could unwrap that for ages.
Well, one thing I like is the word intensely is that it doesn't just mean, again, it doesn't just mean very.
Does that mean more sixth adjutant?
No.
Yeah, with nothing else? No.
Turn it up to 11.
Turn it up to 11. Yeah. Break the knob.
Because you're applying that vertical.
Right. Right. Across the pot.
Spiritual leverage. Right. That's why it's more intense. You're applying that vertical spiritual leverage on a point in time and space, and it's just going to move like nothing else.
Self and its you did it. You know, self and its experiences. Cosmos. Okay. If I take any little thread that has that much extent and bring it down into that self, will that be intense or what? Yeah, right. It's going to be really intense.
Intense. The reason I point that out is because John brought up Tolle, and the Tolleites, or whatever they're called, would do the exact opposite. They would say, forget the past, the future.
Right.
That's just a distraction.
Yeah.
You want to live more intensely in the now, which means forget
divorced.
Everything else.
Divorced,
right.
Divorced from the past
from,
and the future.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Right.
And
right.
It doesn't mean that at all.
Well, just maybe expand that for them, you know, but they might be resistant.
But just see how what he's pointing out is how fundamentally these philosophers always get caught up in their bottom-up viewpoint. Yeah. No matter how grand they think they are in their perspective, they end up with a false exaltation of the bottom-up notion of the present rather than the real present, which comes down from eternity into that moment.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The time unit of immaturity concentrates meaning value into the present moment in such a way as to divorce the present of its true relationship to the non-present.
To the not present.
To the not present.
We're just describing.
The past future.
Yep.
Right. The time unit of maturity is proportioned so to reveal the coordinate relationship of past, present, future, hyphenated, that the self begins to gain insight into the wholeness of events, begins to view the landscape of time from the panoramic perspective of broadened horizons, begins perhaps to suspect the non-beginning, non-ending, eternal continuum, the fragments of which are called time.
Broadened horizons. One might even say perfecting
horizons.
But
he fits a plug in.
Really, marketing.
It's just a reminder of why that we've given this effort that we're on. You know, we've engaged ourselves in that name. Because they tell us to, right there. You know, and the non-beginning, non-ending, eternal continuum? Yeah, the infinite eternal ellipse. And notice right in the middle of that, how did we start out in our meditation? The time unit of maturity is proportioned so to reveal the coordinate, and that's a mother word, coordinate relationship of past, present, future, that the self begins to gain insight into the wholeness of events. The self actually begins to have a relation to the whole.
Proceeding
and
what?
Through the individuality of the whole to other selves. See? I just, like, you know, that's why we say that, because they're just reminding you. This is why they're talking about this. We want to have relationship from one person to another. But, you know, it's the selves that have to come into relationship. So first, the personality has to recognize its responsibilities and take control of itself and get this full integrated system in play. And then, you know, it begins to have some relationship to the whole, a relation to the whole. And then and only then, through the individuality of the whole, are those selves going to begin to come together in the brotherhood of man.
Recognizing the value of the other.
But just to, you know, see the whole point of what, you know, he says, is this going to be about physics? Yeah, the physics of relationship.
Right.
You can't just wish relationship into existence. It has to go through all of these steps. There's a process. It doesn't just magically happen. You know, this distinction is vital. They're not connected with each other, except in relation to the whole. It's like, well, how do I get that relation to the whole? Well, that's what we're reading in this section. It comes about by fully getting this personality, self-system linked, and they've given you all kinds of nice ways to think about it. You have the wisdom, insight, foresight, downstepping and linking into the past, future, you know, perspective of the self with experience and wisdom. And see, they're putting it all together so you can really start to think about this. And the patience is that a gateway there too, and all this is, it's all right here.
Look at how that,
how it fits together.
Maturity as a threshold to this true brother.
Right. You know, and it all goes back to a God nucleus. I mean, everything. It's all here. How do you go about actualizing the brotherhood of man? Well, you don't just say, well, it's not, you know, it doesn't have to do with me. It has to do with, let's get enough people to all wishfully think it, and then it just happens. No.
They're just initializing.
Right. Yeah, you know, all they have is this magic, you know, father-like notion of initiating
all
things.
All voltage, no current.
You know?
But we're going to have a brotherhood game.
It takes a real process, and it starts with you, you know, getting this self under control and linked tightly. And more eternalized like this.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
Well, there's a conception or misconception I've often had of patience is that it's a passive thing.
Right.
You know, when you're being patient.
Patience is.
You're being passive to events.
So neutrality.
True patience is a very active.
Yeah. It is one of, there's mere patience, and then there's the patience as one of the cosmic facets here. You know, facets of cosmic character.
And the cosmos,
you
know, is dynamic.
To elevate patience into this new dynamic foundation for a whole cosmic character. You know, patience is the gateway there too. Every single one of these things is predicated on the third level of meaning combined with the other ones. You know, and it's just trivial. You know, it's just like saying that I am the way, you know, and you know, you can't get to Havon unless you go through Salvington, all those sorts of things, you know, we think about. I mean, you can't get to that, to the temple, except through patience. It's the only doorway.
Yeah.
The spirit of wisdom is the only doorway through. You can't go around it. There's only one way. You know? And in it, the spirit of wisdom doesn't come from the Father. Comes from the mother. This distinction is vital. Okay? Even within yourself, there's no way to link those two things except through mother likeness. You know? That's why it says this distinction is vital. All right.
On the levels of the infinite and the absolute, The moment of the present contains all of the past as well as all of the future. I am signifies also I was and I will be. And this represents our best concept of eternity and the eternal. On the absolute and eternal level, potential reality is just as meaningful as actual reality. Only on the finite level and to time-bound creatures does there appear to be such a vast difference. To God, as absolute, an ascending mortal who has made the eternal decision is already a paradise finaliter. But the Universal Father, through the indwelling thought adjuster, is not thus limited in awareness, but can also know of and participate in every temporal struggle with the problems of the creature ascent from animal-like to godlike levels of existence.
Wow. Okay, and now think about that literally and not magically. Let's see, we want to constantly challenge ourselves to understand the adjuster and not just have a magical notion about the adjuster. To really think about how the adjuster works. How does that come about, what they just said there? You know that technically, they emphasize it right up front. There's nothing more existential than the self-existent self of the Father. Okay?
Yeah.
That is like existentialness of existentialness. You know, he's the absolute of absolutes, okay? There's nothing more removed than the experiential, okay? So when they say something like, but the Universal Father, through the indwelling adjuster, thought adjuster, you know, et cetera, engages, you know, experientially, you know that's not directly. How technically does that come about? What is the interfacing mechanism? How does Father connect to yourself? When there's nothing more basally experiential than our lowly animal origin selves, animal likeness, to at the other end, the existential godlikeness of the Father, there isn't anything more removed. What bridges the gap? There's the Father-like core, the adjuster, but that doesn't directly touch your
truth.
No. Not in that sense, but it's just in a direct, intimate sense of your mindal energy system. You have this existential father-like core, this self-existent self-like core. It's self-experiential deity, after all. I mean, talk about closed back and not connecting to me. You know, what am I interested in your experiences? I've got self-experience. You want to just think about it simplistically. Okay, self-experiential deity is not going to connect with me as this lowly experiential fact. Directly, what is that existential father-like core wrapped? Mother-likeness. The adjuster is not, it has an existential core and an experiential casing. You know, the moment it leaves the Vennington, it begins to wrap mother-likeness, it begins to wrap a self around that existential core. And remember how the more advanced it is, the more of an advanced, even in supreme mother-like, self it has wrapped around that father-like beingness.
That's what they call it, self-acting.
The more efficiently it can connect to ourself, self to self. Again, why did we're talking about self? We're talking about origins of self. Okay, I mean, you can't. Self can only connect to other self. The adjuster can't just be the beingness of its father likeness. It has to have a mother likeness, a self that can connect to our self.
So is that wrapping kind of like a mother of pearl?
Yeah.
Is it like glue or connective tissue?
Well, you're going to fuse with it. You know, so this glue thing, why could you stick? Again, if it was just a father-like thing, it's pure Teflon, infinite Teflon. There's no way you could stick to it. You could slip no matter how hard you smacked against it. There's no way you'd stick to it.
It doesn't want to be sticked to
it. It's self-experiential.
It's a quality of other.
There's no Velcro things sticking out. You know, they're all wrapped back on themselves.
No grippy.
Okay? No grippy. Right? It's only the mother likeness that has the stickiness.
So
self-existential.
You know? Okay? See, that, and that's what, you know, that's what you need to recognize, is put this all together logically. You know, try to dispel more and more of the gaps. It's like, well, it happens somehow or other. I don't want to call it magic because I know I'm not supposed to do that, but I guess I really am because I'm not. You know, try to engage those gaps. Put it together. See, and again, the mother is just the key. I mean, yeah. You can finally put everything together.
Hey, Chris, how do you, the other piece of this, I know you were getting to the mother, but the other piece of it is the personality circuit. The father is personality, me is personality, and that connection.
Right. How did the whole, you know, the only way that this self could take on mother likeness, it could stick to the mother likeness of the adjuster, how was that started?
By the personality. Personality.
You're obviously not going to have any sort of a self that's going to somehow be taking on a more eternalized character, a more mother-like character, without the personality. The personality initiates the whole process.
Yeah.
The
so
father,
it's integral,
right? The father is the initiator, and the mother is the focalizer.
Chris, you were saying self
works.
Recognizes self. I thought you. I don't know if that's correct. If I'm correctly interpreting you correctly. But I know I've heard that personality can recognize other personalities.
Right.
Is there a difference in that?
The adjuster is not a personality. And then that's what I was trying to get at.
Pre-personality.
You know, the adjuster is just a self. So your personality doesn't stick to it. Your self sticks to it. Okay? Your personality initiated the process so that that self could be made something that that... It has more than just the name self in common. I mean, obviously, it's got to be, it's a little bit more sophisticated than that. It has to be mother-like self to mother-like self. Universal harmony to universal harmony. After all, it's that's what's in common. It's a universal harmony. They're the same harmony, so they stick together.
So, they always talk about how the adjuster's sort of goal is to acquire personality.
Yeah.
But... until we're first-stage spirits, the personality is still seated kind of to the side, right? So it, I mean, it still isn't, hasn't directly acquired personality.
Right, you don't have that full personality identification totally on. You know, it's progressively becoming more and more identified on the adjuster, combined, you know, ascender-adjuster self. But as long as there's some ascender self that has Marantia scaffolding underneath it, you know, that's a personality identification point still. It hasn't been moved on top and brought all together. That whole bit about your identity, you know, you have a Marantia identity there. Personality engages an identity. That's the point of identification. That's why it's called an identity. So as long as you're not just a, you know, until you're first stage spirit, you aren't just a spirit identity. There's a Marantia identity there. Yeah. Yep. Okay. So you can kind of see, just glancing forward to the next two sections, what they're doing with the title of this paper, Time and Space. So first they did time. You know, and you know when we're talking about omnipresence and ubiquity, we're bringing in space. And then they time space together. Okay, so that's their first little little game they're playing with us here, is just leading us through the parenthetical of the title. So that's where we'll pick up next time. And hopefully as we're going through, we'll begin to get a little bit more of a sense of how the first thing we were talking about there was tied more tightly to the Supreme, and this next stuff we're going to talk about is tied more tightly to the Ultimate, and maybe we might even start to have an appreciation of the Supreme Ultimate if we stick those two together. All right, let's take a moment here.